A little idle chatter about the people that we know. And though it doesn't matter, is there a different way of saying hello?
You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit www.questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hello, this is Meg Riley in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and you've joined us for another episode of The View. Aisha Hauser, where are you?
I'm in Seattle, Washington.
Hey, how is it out there? It's dark, huh?
It's still dark. Yeah, although yesterday we did a beautiful solstice service at our church. So I think we had 40 seconds, or we will get, I guess by the end of the day, 40 more seconds.
Woo!
Look forward to that.
Joanna Fontaine Crawford, you're not complaining about the cold, I bet.
No, it's just cool enough here in sunny Austin, Texas.
Just cool enough. What does that mean in Texas?
You have to put like a jean jacket on.
Yeah, I got a sweater on. That's it. Yeah.
Your cowgirl vest?
No, Doctor Who sweater.
Okay.
Oh, boy. Hank Purse, what do you got there in, where are you?
I'm in lovely Medford, Massachusetts. I'm home, and it's lightly snowing outside. It's nice. It's nice. Yep.
Did you guys get hit with that? We got hit with a polar vortex last week. It was 45 below wind chill kind of thing.
The vortex. Yeah. In fact, the girls' school was closed last Friday, which meant we just went to the Star Wars movie early.
Oh, yeah, that's good. Hey, I have some apparel that you wear when it's cold. Do you want to show us?
Well, yes. Actually, before that, let me say, so the girls, we went to the movies and we were the only school system that closed in our area. So we went to the movies. I went to see Star Wars and the girls went to see Moana, and I get a text from our 11-year-old who has her own phone, and she sends me a text saying we're the only ones in here. I was like, really? Okay, are you okay? Is that okay? Yeah. And then a little while later, I'm watching the movie. All of a sudden, I get another text, and my cinema is only there's only 8 people there, but it's a picture of the two of them up dancing. They're like, all of a sudden they realize, like, no one else is here. We can dance to these songs. And so they took a picture of themselves, like, dancing, it was, once again, one of those things that I kind of went, those are my daughters.
Those are your daughters. Yep. They're your daughters.
Yeah. Oh, and I was telling you before, I'm really bad at buying gifts, whether it's for my daughters or for my wife or anybody. I'm not even very good at buying gifts for myself. But I saw this, because the only winter hats I have are, as my wife says, toques. They're just like little knit caps. And I saw this, I went, this is what I want. And I wanted it just in red. They didn't have it in red in my size. They only had it in red and black check. But I got it. I thought, oh, this is good. Here it is. And I am psyched. My wife, Rebecca, said when she saw it, when I put it on, she went, oh, Reverend Fudd. That's very nice.
It is very Elmer Fudd with a pom-pom.
With a pom-pom there. It's good. It's a Scotch cap. A Scotch cap. It's good.
Well, just tell yourself
make sure that no one accidentally shoots you in the pulpit, thinking you're a deer or something.
It does have ear flaps. I won't pull them down. Maybe we'll see how the rest of the service, rest of our day goes. But yeah,
we might need the ear flaps depending on if we got nothing else. Right. So behind the chalice today, we have Terry Bernor hanging out with Donut Hair in St. Paul, with a hat on. St. Paul, Minnesota. That's a cute hat too. And then we have a special guest, Jackson Crawford, today. So Jackson,
hi,
let's start with you. We wanted to have you come and tell us, because you've just been someplace really interesting, doing something really that none of us has ever done. Tell us what it is.
Yes. So I recently had the really cool opportunity to be a White House intern in the Office of the Vice President.
So you worked with Joe Biden every day?
Not quite, though I did get to see him a number of times. I got to introduce him at one event, which was a very, very cool opportunity. And my day-to-day work consisted of handling basically all of his incoming hard mail and digital correspondence. I would say I got to know him that way, too.
Now, is he really... Go on, Joanna.
Who all did you get to meet?
Oh, yeah, that's what we want to know.
Oh, sure. So naturally, there were the White House, people. So, I did get to meet the president as part of a large group. I, of course, met the vice president. I got to meet and hug First Lady Michelle Obama. But, you know, it's funny, the people that you'll run into that, you know, aren't, you know, D.C. specific. You know, I ran into Seth Rogen. I ran into Macklemore at one point. So you never know who you're going to meet in these situations.
And this one was so exciting to me. When you were working the guard booth recently, who did you get to meet?
Oh, that is true. I did meet Rachel Maddow. That was very cool.
There you go. So now...
Wait. I want to ask, what was the vice president's opinion on all those awesome memes that came out right after the election of the photos of him and President Obama and him just saying all these kind of crazy mean things? What was his take on it? Were you able to get any of that news?
I could tell you his exact opinion, but this is definitely something
that... But then he'd have to tell you.
Yeah, this is something that I would definitely falls under I should not answer.
So is he really, I mean, he just seems kind of like a golden retriever. Is that really what he's like?
Oh, he is fantastic. He is so candid, so genuine. You know, as everyone knows, sometimes even, you know, too genuine for his own good. But he's fantastic.
And what about the First Lady?
Oh, I told my family this, but I mean, she was, what I didn't expect was for the First Lady to be just as candid as the Vice President was, but she absolutely was. You know, she's very, very strategic minded. She very much, she knows her persona as First Lady and she knows how to use that to get things done.
So this is a show about joyous resistance, but I just have to ask you, I mean, you were there at such an amazing, amazing time. You know, I've been thinking about that first inauguration as we approach this one, and that what a difference. I read Ta-Nehisi Coates's piece about his Black president. And I mean, from all accounts, everyone there was as surprised as the rest of us. And really reeling in shock. What was it like to be there then?
Yeah, so there's a lot to say about that. I mean, for one thing, the day after the election was, that was a quiet day across the whole building. I mean, it was, you know, because you did have some people who, you know, whatever your opinions are, you know, these people, their work, quite possibly that what they've been working on for years, you know, might be undone now. For example, I have one of the interns in my office, in the office of the vice president, she worked on stuff related to the Violence Against Women Act. Well, just as an objective fact, we now have an attorney general who does not support that act. So, you know, it had interesting implications for people.
I was there when it turned from Clinton to Bush, and I went to a number of wakes, I would say, of the GLBT office, which of course got completely eliminated, all of the work that had been done for 8 years. And similar, a lot of the people that I knew worked in, when I lived in DC, worked for the EPA and the DOJ, and they were just like, my work is done. You know, one woman said, well, the good news is my husband will be home for dinner every night now. He worked at the EPA. She said everything he worked on is over. And I'm sure it's like that, only really on steroids. I mean, just the number of things that are getting complete reversals.
Yeah.
So did that shift, I mean, you must have dealt then with all of the mail and email and everything in the wake of the election. That must have been a really interesting thing too.
Yeah. I mean, that was interesting. We get mail from both sides, you know, we had people, you know, saying, you know, we certainly had, you know, mail from, you know, Trump supporters and all, but we also did have, we had mail from people that were worried and, you know, don't really know, you know, what's coming. I think, you know, one of the ones that most got to me was actually one that was that we didn't see because, you know, the mail process is long. And so we didn't see this one until after the election, but it had been written before, like just right before the election. And it was actually a very positive, optimistic piece of mail from literally a gay Muslim refugee. And to read that then after the election, it was interesting.
So the President Obama has now publicly talked about how he wants to get involved in kind of a ground game from now on, looking at you know, local Democratic races.
Organizer in chief, he said.
Yes, yes. So what any thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I'm actually glad to know that that's public now. I didn't know that that was public. Otherwise, I wouldn't have said anything. But
Are you going to run for something? Is this an announcement?
No. I don't think I'm. I don't know that I want to be in public service, but I don't know that elected office is quite for me. But yeah, so that was something that the
Oh, wait a minute. Whoa, that was a good political answer. That was a good political answer. I like that. I like this. Like, this is where this is going.
But yeah, something that both the vice president and the president clearly indicated as a priority while I was there was, you know, definitely, you know, rebuilding kind of a defense of, you know, their ideas and such, for at the local and state level. You know, I think one senior level person while I was there expressed the opinion that, you know, one thing is young people are really good at protesting right now, but they haven't necessarily gotten really great about community organizing. That's one really good area for improvement to actually get things done. And so I look forward to that.
So now this is asking your opinion, so you don't have to reveal. So my Congressman Keith Ellison is running for the DNC, heading that. What do you think of that? Do you have an opinion?
So I've been following the DNC race pretty closely. It's been, you know, very interesting. Obviously, a lot of the originally, like, other big candidates, you know, like Howard Dean are now, you know, no longer running. It does look like, you know, Tom Perez is running. I think that Keith Ellison would be a good DNC chair. I think that Tom Perez would also be a good DNC chair. I've seen that Keith Ellison, just recently, I was actually looking from a tweet, I think today, from Keith Ellison, where he was actually tweeting about kind of how an article about how he believes that Hillary Clinton was treated rather unfairly. And frankly, I just think that's I think that's a smart move from him to try to kind of, you know, find the moderates in the party and try to get them behind him as well.
Yeah, he's a community organizer. I would miss him as a congressman, but already like seven people have stepped forward here and said if he, all people of color, which is exciting, different couple Native America, and just a real panoply of people. But anyway, he's been good in that role.
Can I ask a quick question? How many interns of color were actually in the White House? Because remember that picture of, who was that guy, Paul Ryan? All the Republican interns were just a sea of white. You almost had to put sunglasses on. So I'm wondering if the interns at the White House were more representative of the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is something where there's a way in which we were very representative and a way in which we weren't as much. So the way in which we were representative is, I would say, you know, with regards to race, certainly with regards to gender, I'm pretty sure there were, in fact, more women interns than men. I would say in that respect, we were very diverse, very representative. If there was one way, and many people, you know, have noted this over time, and it's something that I hope can be improved in the future, is that we probably are not as economically diverse as we could be, because when you have this thing that's an unpaid internship in an area, you know, with a high cost of living, you know, people have to make that work somehow. You know, for me, you know, I was really grateful to, you know, get some help from my school, from a family member. But to do something like this, someone has to come through for you, and not everyone has that. And I feel very lucky that I do have that.
Now, Could it have been just as likely that you would have been an intern the beginning of the new president's term? I mean, do you apply to work with a specific president? Like, will the people who now go in be more aligned with the new president's priorities of destroying the government? Or, I'm just like, it would have been horrible for you to be doing a lot of things that were anathema to your value system. How does that work with interns?
Yeah, so you apply by semester. There's a spring, summer, and fall semester. So you know which president you're applying to, and the internship program is through the administration. That said, we certainly had, we had Republicans, who were interning, for the Obama administration. Generally, they were Republicans that very much believed in the mission of the Obama administration, but, we had Republicans, so you have cross-party stuff. There are other programs in the White House, like the White House Fellows Program, that are more strictly bipartisan, where no matter who's president, they're looking to get about half and half, people from each party. But I would say, as far as the White House internship program, it tends to generally be more aligned just out of people, who apply with the president.
Interesting. My experience was the Clinton White House invited in a very diverse, say, religious group. I mean, there were always all the things that I went to, there were evangelicals and people across the spectrum. When President Bush came in, that was no longer true. They only invited in people who absolutely believed what they did. And I wonder if that will be true again. I mean, a tolerance for different viewpoints is not a hallmark of a close non-liberal mind. And I don't mean liberal politically. I mean that liberal in the sense of being open-minded and wanting the best answer, even if it comes from different places. I got invited to the Bush White House once in 8 years. I used to run the DC office, which is why I would have been invited. With the Clinton White House, by the end, we were like, no, you go. It's just, you learn when you live there that being invited to the White House means going to a different building and being with aides, basically, So it sounds a lot, you picture yourself in the Oval Office, but that's just not what it means, 99%, unless it's a bill signing. That's really it. So anyway.
Absolutely.
But that's exciting that you got to do that. What a moment for you. I bet you'll look back on it the rest of your life. Hank?
I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I was actually just kind of wondering, you talked about people going to, who will go there. And I wonder if part of it will also be like, who will apply? I was just looking at, with a bunch of my rock and roll friends, the list of the bands performing at the inauguration and all the problems because nobody wants to play and how they've had to sort of call in these sort of like experts and from Hollywood and New York to try to get A-list artists and somebody said this is what happens when you lose the coasts you get DJs who are going to play and There was a cover band, an 80s cover band.
He's got Ted Nugent and Kid Rock, right?
Right. But even they haven't been, really, that's, I think those are maybe more like after party stuff. What my favorite thing was that there was this cover band, this 80s cover band called The Reagan Years. I was like, you're making this up. You are making this up. But it's not,
What parent would want one of their daughters to go be an intern there? I know now from Jackson that it's not like you're hanging out, with the president all of the time, but most parents don't know that, we had no real idea what to expect with the intern program before Jackson went. And boy, yeah, I wouldn't want my daughters there.
Yeah, staffing in general is going to be interesting for them because their transition team found out relatively late in the process that they were going to have to fill like the vast majority of White House and Eisenhower executive building jobs, they have open job application on on greatagain.gov, you know, just looking for basically anyone, you know, let alone interns. So that, I'll be very interested to see, you know, what kind of people they get, especially at those, you know, lower kind of levels within the White House.
Oh, boy. Well, thanks, Jackson. Thanks for dropping in and telling us about that. That's cool.
Go and make me some Chex Mix.
And now, I always had pictured you running for office. So did this experience make you less interested in that, or were you doing what Hank said and just giving a really politic answer that you would have given before?
Well, so, I mean, if I'm just being blunt about it, the internship itself, you know, didn't necessarily, you know, sway me one way or the other on elected office. The election, however, that happened while I was, you know, in this internship, did maybe make the idea of elected office a little less appealing to me. But I still, you know, very much want to be in the government. I still very much want to, you know, be a public servant. Just maybe in a more bureaucratic role, in which, if there's anything that I've learned, you know, bureaucracy gets a bad name, and a surprising amount can be accomplished, you know, through that.
Amen. Let's hope it's still there when this administration is done, right? Because some of the people in it are very committed to eliminating many, many, many jobs in the government. So, yeah. All right. Well, thanks for coming in. And this probably bugs you, but you look so much like Tom. God, it's a little bit freaky. Do you get that a lot?
I heard that.
That's Joanna's husband, for people who wonder, not her other
not the mailman.
All right. Well, thanks for dropping in.
Absolutely. Thank you. Right. Bye.
Party mix on. So Hank has disappeared. We don't know where he's gone. So I thought
he decided to go apply to gov.
I was just thinking that. I was like, oh, we should apply. We should plant some of our folks. It wouldn't be a bad thing.
Wouldn't be a bad thing for the people on the outside getting the information, but oh God, yeah. You'd have to shower every day a lot.
Yeah, that's true.
We used the title today, I think, Joy is a Form of Resistance or something like that. And I have come to that, you know, after really just getting just not, you know, punched in the solar plexus physically and emotionally, I thought, oh, no, you don't get my joy, buddy. You're going to take a lot of stuff, but you are not taking my joy in life. And so I've been really deliberately savoring joyful moments and, you know, just seeing your faces and all of that. And so I was going to lead off with a really delightful moment I had yesterday and then invite you all to just share joys that you're having. Yesterday was, you know, the morning after the solstice. And I have a good friend, Sheila, who's super witchy and really does, you know, stays up all night every solstice with her teenage daughter. And they always come around and do something magic in my yard. But often, sad to say, I forget to look and they like put a candle and I'll just see like a burned out candle in the middle of the day and go, oh God, I missed that. I bet it was beautiful. Well, this year, knowing that that has happened, they took orange slices and strung them and hung them in my magnolia bush right outside my window. And they're like a mobile kind of, and they're like suns, you know, with the radial. It is such a simple thing. But it's so beautiful. So as Aisha was saying, it stays dark really late here too in the north. And so I'm sitting and it's dark, but I can see this thing moving. And I'm like, what? What is that? And as the light comes in, it's gray, foggy light. There's just this beautiful yellow orange spinning going on. And I just thought, what a simple thing to absolutely just make my morning. And I just kind of sat with a cup of coffee and watched them spin for a good half an hour, actually. And, you know, I just thought that much joy can be given to someone else that easily. So anyway, that was my yesterday absolute delight moment. How about you, old Aisha? What's giving you joy?
So last Saturday night, I went out with six other women from the Unitarian Church, one of them who is 85, who still teaches yoga and can do a split. And we went to see a show, a gay burlesque show called Homo for the Holidays. And this is in Seattle, Capitol Hill, and it's my third year going. And what the star of the show, Ben de la Creme, grew up Unitarian. And the show is all about chosen family. And they also have you know, we have Hanukkah represented by Menorah Lezowitz. And I forgot, I think the other character is Dreidel. So it's just hilarious, but it's also very touching. And they, so one of the skits in the show is that Santa needs to be replaced. So they start saying, well, of course, Mrs. Santa is really qualified and, you know, no one's more qualified than her. And then they said, well, here's who won the vote. And they came out with a canned ham. And they said, well, that doesn't make any sense. And it was just a riot. And then they started, and then the whole theme of the show is, of this show is, you know, we have to stick together. And they made us all part of the LGBT community because they, you know, do shout outs of who's here and how about allies? Well, you're all gay tonight. And so it was wonderful. And I thought to myself toward the end, I said, this is part of resistance because, you know, some in the new administration are just, this would make them, you know, faint in vapors. And I said, this is what we have to do is support what is already very strongly here. And so I loved it. And it was just perfect. And it was very sweet. And he almost did a mini homily at the end about how much we're going to need each other and self-care. And I said, gosh, Ben de la Creme could be a UU minister. So it was awesome. So those of you who are friends of mine on Facebook, you could see pictures of me at HOMO for the holidays. So that was a bit of joy. And I said, we have to hold on to that. And at the same time, support communities that are absolutely going to need our money and our significant support. So that was my bit of joy this past week. It was fabulous.
Hank, how about you? You a creator.
Sure. Well, let me first start with a quote from Martin Luther. Whenever the devil harasses you, seek the company of men, or drink more, or joke and talk nonsense, or do other merry things. Sometimes we must drink more, sport, recreate ourselves, and even sin a little to spite the devil, so that we leave him no place for troubling our consciousnesses with trifle. We are conquered if we try too consciously not to sin at all. So when the devil says to you, do not drink, answer him, I will drink and write freely just because you tell me not to. I love that, you know, because, you know,
Martin Luther said that?
Martin Luther said, oh, yeah. Oh,
constipated Martin Luther said that?
Martin Luther's quotes are just full of drinking beer and swearing. He was.
Did you get that from a reputable news site, Hank? I would check your source.
No, that's, yeah. He was all about, you know, sort of fighting the devil with, you know, with a beer can in one hand and the Bible in the other. But you know, I think it's so easy for us to get to go, all right, we got to double down. We got to, you know, gird our loins. We got to, and just get so serious and so glum. And there's no space for anything light at all, because everyone just feels like, I mean, you know, our new president and his cabinet haven't even taken hold yet. They haven't even been sworn in yet. And we're all like, oh, you know, and it's like, look, you know, I mean, even if he's the greatest president ever, how he got there was horrible and has ruined anything positive for a lot of us. But I think also, you know, we can take ourselves way too seriously and we take them too seriously. And the one thing that you keep seeing with Trump is that, you know, and I think Jackson said this too, that he hates being laughed at. He hates he hates anyone making fun of him. And you know, I spoke to my dad this morning, and he was saying how when Trump was over in Scotland this summer opening some golf course of his, all of these people in this little village in Scotland they'd rented out a mariachi band outfit, and they played all these sort of Mexican music, and they had a big wheelbarrow full of bricks for, like, you know, start your wall here. And it drove him out of his mind, and he went to the local cop and said, like, how can you get rid of these guys? And he said, I can't, they live here, you know. And so I think there's if there's somebody who hates humor, it's our next president, and especially at his expense. So you know, that you know, so that always, you know, I you know, I think one of the things that's often been missing from our liberal faith is the two things. One is joy, and the other is humility. You know, the idea that we could be wrong about things, but also the idea of joy that even, you know, I mean, some of it is this morning of waking up and kind of going, all right, the solstice, the darkest night has passed, and we're going to have a little bit more light today. And so I think there's always those sort of things too. And can I also just say a great thing I saw yesterday was some lovely friends of mine who live down south, and they have for the last few years been foster parents. Forgot the word. They've been foster parents, and they just adopted these two boys and their younger sister yesterday. That all became finalized. They hadn't been able to share it until yesterday. So all of a sudden, seeing like this photo, now they have six children living with them, and it is a truly joyful thing for me to see the greater herd of Carvels who are living down in Tennessee, and I'm just overjoyed to hear that news that they were able to finally share with all of us too.
That's great. That is, it's good to remember when people are cursing 2016. I think, but wait, my niece had a little Marquito in 2016, and Adam and Meredith had a little Phoenix. And wait, we don't want to get rid of the whole year. There's new babies coming in. So yeah, it's good to remember that. Joanna, this thing of joy and hard times has been one of your themes for a long time.
Well, and I'm kind of experiencing it this year. My dad died in July, but in June, he and my mom moved down here. And in fact, my mom and I have come to feel like this was his final gift to my mom, you know, was to move her close. And so, you know, we're definitely sad, but we're also having a heck of a lot of fun. You know how with little kids, you know, when you start having children, you talk about how, oh, you get to see everything through their eyes and it's like everything is new. Well, let me tell you, the same can be said for sharing things with an 85-year-old woman who has apparently missed out on like every holiday movie there has ever been, or at least from like the last 25 years. So we've been introducing her to, you know, the Santa Claus and, this week, Scrooged, right? Came out in 1987. I have no idea how she managed to miss this, but so we sat down and had a bread and cheese night and watched that and, you know, just had a ball.
A viewer said they're sorry for your loss. That's really sweet. Thank you, viewer. Yeah, so there's that grief on top of the cultural grief that we're all going through. I mean, and I noticed that a lot of people who have their own stresses on their individual lives and families, you know, it can get big. So, one, you know, movies are definitely one of the things that you turn to. But I also really wanted you to share, you wrote a piece about Santa Claus and what you do with your kids around Santa Claus. If there are kids watching, this is private information about Santa Claus that kids can't know. So you might want to stop watching now. But Joanna, I was really inspired by what you wrote, and I wondered if you'd share your Santa Claus theory.
So, first of all, I deeply, deeply, deeply believe in Santa Claus. So I have to be really clear about that. And there are different ways of understanding Santa. And so with our kids, we call the first, we call it different levels of Santa Claus. And so level one is, you know, the whole, everything is literally true. You know, Santa comes down your chimney and all of that. And we really do that up big, you know, like the chewed up carrots in the yard and letters from Santa and just, you know, everything. And then when they are ready, and I think part of it is to know when they are really ready. And with all of our kids, we've all seen around second or third grade, you think they're ready, but they're not. What they're doing is, this is part of childhood development. They're looking for the information to augment the case. So for ours, it has actually been around age 11. And so they and they always got a letter from Santa Claus, you know, a couple of days before Christmas. But at age 11, they get a letter that says, I know you've had a lot of questions about me. Look under your pillow December 26th, and those questions are going to be answered. And so on December 26th, they pull out a letter that explains that Santa is so much bigger than what they've even imagined, that there's this worldwide conspiracy of millions of people being Santa. And if they want to, they now get to be part of Santa Claus. But they have to make the choice. They can either just walk away and say, nope, there's no Santa, or... And all of mine have said yes. So that's level two.
Let me just say, wait, I've got an 11-year-old in my house. That is awesome. Okay, sorry, go back. Sorry.
Thank you. Yeah, well, and part of mine was I did not find out in a good way as a kid. And with my kids, I was like, I need to explain this better. So level three is when you are Santa for your own kids or kids that you're raising. Level four is when you are Santa Claus for someone who you're not related to, which means that a child can actually be a level four before they're a level three. And then level five is the top. That's the people who dress up like Santa Claus or Mrs. Claus. And this is the first year where all of my kids are level two or above. Marina got her letter last year. And last year was so cool because here at the church, we actually have a level five Santa. And it was one that my kids had sat on his lap at the mall. And there is this Santa Claus magic. No one at the kids at the church, no one has ever connected the person with Santa Claus. And he has a long white beard, but Santa Claus magic. No one has ever made that connection. So with my daughter, I was able to say, oh, and you know, a level five Santa. And I named him. And like a couple of days later, she still wasn't getting it. And I was like, no, that's, you know, this person. Anyway, so it was amazing. And this year, so to kind of cap it all off, this year, the level five Santa that we have at the church, he does this event every year where they bring all these foster families out and, you know, do activities, and they get to have their picture taken with Santa. And it's a little chaotic. And so Santa asked my girls if they would come and be his elves and level up. And they all got to do that. And that was a great experience. Yeah.
Now, you do that in your family. Have you introduced that to your congregation? Is that catching on with other people there? Or?
So I wrote a blog piece about it, and I'm sure we can put up the link somewhere. And so it's, you know, every year about November, people start emailing me and saying, what's that link again? You know, like they read it, and then they're actually, their child is at a certain age, or they have a niece or a nephew, and they say, okay, it's time to do that.
That is so interesting about second or third grade. I remember when my own kid was in third grade and they said to me, I'm going to ask you something. And if you lie to me about this, I will never believe you about anything again. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what is this going to be? You know? So I go, okay. Is there a Santa Claus, or do you and Kendrick do it? And so I had said, you know, I will try really hard to tell the truth. So I said, Kendrick and I do it. You do not. You couldn't put that Playmobil together, blah, 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 you know. And I'm like, well, Paula helped us do that. You're right. We couldn't have done that. So then we're watching the movie Elf later, you know, how the sleigh won't go up because no one believes in Santa, is bumping along the ground. And my kid turns to me and goes, it's people like you that keep that sleigh from flying.
Yeah, and I have to say, there was one of my children who probably, like, you know, she never would have really been at that appropriate age ever, because she got mad at us, but not mad at us for sharing this larger truth. I mean, not mad at us for originally the whole level one Santa, but angry that we told her the truth. You know, even though it was this larger and more generous truth, she wanted to stay a level one forever.
Cat Lou wrote such an interesting Facebook post yesterday or the day before about how people believe in God and Santa Claus, and it doesn't seem to upset them. So why can't they believe in other gods as well? You know, and I thought, yeah, that's kind of true. You know, you got these things and they're not causing me any pain. Like, what's wrong with pulling in a few other deities here? Not that Santa's a deity. I don't mean to imply that, but, you know, a bodhisattva maybe. So Hank, you've got an 11-year-old, huh?
Yes, I certainly do. And you know, and there's just definitely been those things where she said, like, come on, we know it's you moving the elf at night, which, I mean, can I just say, I don't know who invented that elf on the shelf thing. I was not happy about that damn thing coming in.
Awful.
I like someone
that,
had made
that came after my time.
Someone made one, and I posted a couple years ago. It was around Thanksgiving, called a Puritan on the Shelf, and it was this little pilgrim boy, and who gave stern looks at you whenever you should be doing something, like the little Calvinist on the on your shoulder, like, oh God, oh, I won't do that. But oh, that elf on the shelf thing, man, and because you have to remember each night to move it. That's the worst part. If it was just there, like, oh, there it is, like having to move it in, like. You know, I forgot the other day, like, I forgot to move it. Like, oh, what happened? Oh, I must have touched it by mistake. Like, oh.
Yeah, I would just say, oh, you obviously stayed up too late last night.
Oh, that's good. Oh, you're blaming them. Oh, that's good. I like that. That's good.
Oh, that's good, Joanna. That's blame good. The kids. Blame the kids.
That's good. That's good. I like that. That's good. Yeah, no. I do like this. Your idea of like helping other people being big. All right, I'm gonna look up your stuff and copy that letter. It's like, you know, it's like the Hogwarts letter that Ruth also got when she turned 11. It really is interesting seeing your kids grow up. I mean, it's as I'm rewriting my minister's record for getting into the search process this year. You know, thinking about like what things have really affected me and how much fatherhood really has, you know, and you always sort of think, you know, it's like one of those things everyone says, like, kids grow up so fast. And you're like, yeah. And then you realize, like, oh, they really do. Those damn people who always said that stuff, they were really right. Oh, gosh, now I'm one of them, too. You know, and, you know,
the days are long and the years are short.
Right. Exactly. And it's all, and also it's all a phase, too. That's the other one I like. That both the good and the bad, it's all a phase. I think also my concept of God has changed as well. You know, I just took a preaching class this past semester at over at Andover Newton, where I'd gone to seminary. They have a, you know, sort of a visiting ministers program while they still have a campus. And so it was a preaching without notes class, and it was great. And it was also great. We met on Wednesdays, and so we met like the day after the election. So we were all sort of, you know, I had other adults I wasn't responsible for to talk to. But you know, in that class, you know, I talked about how I grew up as a, I was a teenage atheist, you know, and even though it was never explicit in the congregation I grew up in, but it was implicit. And something you heard adults say and other folks say, that like anybody who believed in God was weak, and you know, and it just kind of gets put back of your head. You're like, yeah. And then like in my early 20s, I remember just like being like depressed. I'd gotten fired or dumped or both or something, and walking down the street and finding a penny and picking it up and doing the whole like, see a penny, pick it up all day, have a good luck. And then like two blocks later, realizing I still had the penny, I was still making a wish, and then going, am I saying a prayer? Does this mean I believe in God? And if this means I believe in God, does that mean that I'm weak? And going like, hey, jackass, you are pretty weak right now. And let's see what maybe believing in God's like, you know. And then my belief in God was very much like, really developed into being like, God was sort of like Harvey the Invisible Rabbit, you know, my friend who was there, a witness to the, maybe sometimes the stuff I had to put up with, and also the voice in my ear that went, maybe not, you know. And that was great. And all of a sudden with fatherhood, I'm realizing, you know, now that I've had a bit of time to reflect on fatherhood after 11 years, almost 12 years, that I that my concept of God, I think, has also expanded. I realized that my understanding of God that was limited in some ways, which was fine, but now that limited God was for me. And now I think being able to do this, to have a different belief, that I should at least be able to expand. I don't know if it will, but at least I should be open to a different understanding of how the sacred, you know, works in my life. Anyway, boy, I got serious. Oh my God. Sorry. Oh crap.
Yeah, you went off. I was going to ask Aisha about Santa and now it feels like Aisha.
Well, I grew up Muslim. And so I didn't think Santa liked Muslim kids. So I don't have the frame of reference of, I didn't. And, you know, my peer, and I grew up in Belleville, New Jersey, a working class community where Santa was huge and kids got all their, it seemed like everything they wanted for the year, they got on Christmas morning through a list for Santa. And it just felt so far enough for me. Obviously, my mother's like, we don't do Santa, we're Muslim. And I'm like, but, and then this was when TV, you know, everybody watched TV. I don't think that's the case anymore. And so all the TV specials would involve Santa's miracles with everybody. And it just made me sad that Santa hated Muslim people, or maybe he just didn't like me. So when I got older, I wanted to do Santa for my kids, and my husband's Jewish. And so he was like, yeah, whatever, have at it. And so we did it only for a few years. And at one point, you know, my husband kind of got annoyed because I would do the bells and I really wanted to have my kids believe because I felt so like I missed out. So she was about five, my daughter, when my husband's like, you know, enough of this crap, we're going to tell her. And I'm like, okay. So we sit down and he's like, Layla, you know, there's no Santa, it's us. She puts her little hand on his knee and goes, of course there is, Daddy. And then I just looked at him and said, you better leave her alone. She wants to believe. And so it lasted probably another 3 years and then she was over it. And my son, who's a reverend, is all at Get Out at a Catholic school, let the cat out of the bag in first grade. And I had a mob of Italian, you know, North New Jersey housewives just want me out of the school because they were so angry that my son did this. And the principal of the school actually had to intervene. I don't know how I end up in these situations in my life. And I got called into the principal's office and she was awesome. She said to me, you belong here. She said, your son is in first grade. He did not do anything malicious. You know, if she said, had this been a fifth or sixth grader, that's one thing. But she said, you belong here and I will take care of the mothers and you didn't do anything wrong. It was so sweet. She didn't have to, because let me tell you, these mothers had pitchforks, had Christmas pitchforks with tinsel on them and they wanted me dead. So, anyway, it was, so I've had a kind of a mixed thing with Santa.
That's so interesting. You know, I remember being in a public school and they had a reindeer Santa thing and a Jewish mom was furious. She was like, this Christian stuff. And I was like, I guess the reindeer are Christian. Like, it was so, to me, not a Christian story, but of course it's all framed around the Christian story. So,
yeah.
Terry, you have a Christmas story to share? You don't have sound, hon. We can't hear you.
Oh, no.
That's weird. She had sound before. Why don't you act it out and we'll guess what happened? No, I'm kidding. That's really weird. Oh, well, she had a good story. I have no idea. We were chatting before the thing and it was just fine. That's Google Hangouts. You know, I've been thinking about this what you tell kids stuff. I know, she's gone. Hopefully we're still live. I've been thinking about it because people are trying to figure out how to talk to their kids after the election. And I don't, Joanna, you and Hank, you've got younger kids. Well, Aisha, your kids are younger too. I mean, my kid, I don't need to tell my kid anything about the election. My kid is like Jackson, very, very well informed. But I just wonder how your conversations are going at home. And you know, if you find yourself with ethical, I mean, I know parents who are like, of course I didn't tell my kid how scared I am. And I was like, well, I did, because it would have been impossible not to, because it was so obvious that my kid would think I was like delusional if I weren't, you know. So I'm curious how those conversations are going. You know, I listened to what, you know, the president said to his daughter, and I'm like, what a disciplined man, so much more generous than you. Hey, Terry, wait, are you there?
I am.
Okay, why don't you do your Santa story, and then we'll move into this other piece. So
I just accidentally closed Google Hangout, and I thought I killed the entire view there for just a second. So I have no idea what you were just talking about. Okay, so here's my Santa story. I grew up in northern Minnesota in the outside Duluth in the country, and we were a pretty poor family. And so I don't ever really remember about Santa. Like, I literally never remember going and sitting on Santa's lap at the mall, which would have been like, I don't know, a half hour or 45 minute drive away. And we always opened our presents on Christmas Eve. We never, ever opened them Christmas Day. I know we were one of those weird families.
What?
I know. So we would go to our country Lutheran church, our rural little sweet little Lutheran church. And then we would open up presents before that. Then we would go to church, and then we would come home. And at that time, there's no such thing as cable. So we just had, you know, the three basic channels plus PBS. And we would turn on the TV so that we could watch the Pope at the Vatican do the Christmas Mass. We had no connection to Catholicism at all, knew nothing about it. So in some ways, it was like Pope was Santa. Pope was the gift that we got after going to our little Lutheran church. And then the next morning we would wake up and we would get our stockings that were full. So if nothing else, Santa was really cheap because all we got was like an orange and an apple and some nuts and a little mini candy cane in our stocking. And that would be what we'd get from Santa. And our parents would give us the really, really good stuff the night before we went to church. It was weird. I know. So no Santa story, really.
Well, no. Santa's cheap. That's the story. That's Santa, it. That cheapskate.
Yeah. No. And I think, I mean, all those, you know, and the things that I do with my kids, you know, my dad always would come down early and light the wood stove and then start making porridge before we could even come down, you know. And so now I do that with my kids. And of course, and my parents' house is much larger than where we live. And so, they're my girls are, you know, we have sort of an open concept house. So the girls are like, come on, hurry up with the porridge, daddy. We gotta, you know, and so I just make them wait longer. You know, I just do it just to torture them. And, you know, and hopefully that they too will have children one day and they too will torture their kids. So, you know, it's a good, you know, good thing to pass along.
So I'm curious, who all is having to work Christmas morning, or excuse me, getting to work Christmas morning? Aisha, you're not?
Nope, we are close. We're having lay-led services on the 25th and January 1st. So I'm going to get two Sundays in a row. What? Actually, I'm going to the African American Museum next week. I'm going to D.C. to see my mom. Cool. I know. My sister works for an embassy. So every now and then I'm like, I actually am okay not visiting the White House. I'd rather go to the African American Museum. Like, if you could swing that. So that's where I'm going next week.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. You know, that kind of stuff. I was thinking about that museum the other day. I was like, yeah, they can't take the museum down. Like, you know, like there are really some things about the history that have been faced that can't be unfaced, despite the desperate desire of some people to unface them. And that reassures me. That reassures me deeply. Well, I brought up a more intense question. Maybe let's set that aside and just stick with holidays. And, you know, we got plenty of time to talk about stuff. But I wanted to mention that one of our viewers wrote that Santa and Elf on the Shelf have made me feel poverty harder as an adult. And I think that it is that message of Santa loving some people and hating some people. And really that I think does carry over. Hank went on a riff about believing in Santa, believing in God. But I think there is a theological element to, you know, God loves rich people because look, they're rich because God loves them. And so God gave them a bunch of stuff. And boy, that sure is not. That's not a Christian concept, to say the least, to say the absolute least. If Jesus has anything to say about anyone, it's people who are greedy. But it's that sense of I know my kid was very mad, not at Santa, but at the Easter Bunny for not going to Jewish kids' houses. So wrote a letter of, you know, this is this kid I raised, wrote this letter in about third grade, like, why don't you go to the Jewish kids' houses? That is mean, you know. So the Easter Bunny wrote back, you know, I go to houses where I am invited only, you know.
I love letters kids write. My daughter was in second or third grade, and I don't know why she did this, but for Thanksgiving, you know, I see her doing a card, and I said, who are you making a card for? And she hands it to me. She goes, it's for the poor. It said, dear poor, I hope you have a happy Thanksgiving. And I'm like, oh, my God, okay, it was so sweet. But one thing I would never let my kids do, even though I wanted them to have Santa, was never write a list of what they wanted. To me, like having grown up poor, we were on welfare and food stamps for a couple of years when my parents first divorced. For me, the idea, and I don't harsh on anyone's mellow for kids who do it, but like for you to just write a list of crap you want real. And my son, because he's ornery like me, would still try to do it. He's like, here's my list. I'm like, you're not getting anything on here. You're going to get what you need. And I'm like, it just felt so for me. Like it even was the opposite of what I decided Christmas was going to be for our Jewish Muslim Unitarian family. So I would not, this whole list thing, I'm like, and I felt, I mean, I'd have mothers, like I said, Jersey, when my kids were younger, were like, what do you mean your kids don't give a list? I'm like, yeah, I'm not doing that. That seems like over the top, unnecessarily to me, privilege that I didn't grow up with. And I didn't want to affirm, like, oh, you just write a list and you get things. Like, no. And so I don't know if that's mean, but it probably is. But that's how I did it. I'm just not into the whole list thing.
We wrote a list and didn't get things, you know. And with my mom, too, my mom being from Northern Ireland, and her tradition growing up was that you'd write your list, and then you'd go to the chimney and you'd light it, and then it would go up the smoke would go up the chimney to Santa that way, you know, and then you maybe go into the city and sit on Santa's lap. But the real way Santa got stuff was by sending up in flames. And you know, and that we should never, you know, you can only do it with your parents there, and you can't do it yourself. So we weren't, you know, trying to send secret messages to Santa, you know, by burning things.
I didn't do anything as smart as Joanna with Santa, but one thing I do feel good about from my kids' young years is that we never said, you know, what did you get? We said, what did you get to give someone? What did you give someone? And we really, really focused in. And you can see with young kids, they are so excited to give things. I remember the year that my kid at like four went back and forth about what to give Kendrick. They knew that Kendrick wanted two things, a new Volkswagen Beetle and peppermint lifesavers. And they were like, which one should I give Kendrick? And I was like, I don't know, you decide. Thank God they decided that Kendrick would prefer the lifesavers, because we would have had to have a talk about money that I really didn't want to have. But I just loved that, you know, they got to weigh those two things equally as with that young mind. Joanna, what? Yeah.
One thing that I love that they do at the church that I serve, and they started doing this a long time ago, is having the Santa level 5 as a member of your congregation. He shows up. We have a parents of young children group, and he shows up to their holiday party, and the children have brought toys to give to him, so that he can give them to other children. And then those are donated to Toys for Tots, which I just think is such a that's the lesson we want to spread.
Yeah. Or making things, you know, making things. Not me, but Kendrick, my co-parent, an artist who just always, and very, very poor, family, but always made amazing, amazing gifts and still does. And is likely to give a gift like a jar with, milkweed seeds, you know, and say, here are your wishes, or, you know, just really, really beautiful, beautiful gifts that, you know, just like I started with the oranges in the yard, what an amazing gift that was for me. And Joanna, you just said you're doing homemade gifts.
Yeah, we're doing for our, because my siblings and Tom's siblings and for our mothers, we're doing homemade gifts, which in the very rare chance that one of them is watching, I won't say what they are, but I will say, like, it was what we were creating involved a sewing machine, and it involved every member of our little family putting these together. And the fact that we didn't kill each other in the process is absolutely another part of the Christmas miracle. So there may be a little blood in these gifts that we're giving.
Yeah, sometimes it sounds a little more fun than it is. Well, it's lovely to see all of you. I love that people piped up with comments as well. Happy holidays to everyone. We will not be having The View next week. We're all just going to chill and do whatever we're doing. I'm going to try to meet with my senators when they're here, although I just talked to Franken's office and he's not coming for a while. But, you know, I think this is a time to use to plan and to... I myself am giving gifts of support to organizations led by people of color that I want to support. And that's what all my siblings are getting for the holidays. You know, it's a time to think about how to bring joy and resistance together in every way that we can. And mm-hmm. we will see you in the new year. We have some really great programs coming. And meanwhile, happy holidays.
However, happy holidays.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Happy Hanukkah. Bye, folks.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.